This is one of the best times of the year to me. We've got college baseball in full swing. We've got MLB. We've got MILB getting ready to go. If you love baseball like I do, and I guess if you're listening to this, you probably do, it's a constant, never-ending stream of baseball. There's so much to watch, so much to keep up with. But when I'm late getting home from a game, or if I'm even just up late watching games on many of the various sources, I have to admit, that alarm goes off in the morning and I get a pretty strong reminder that I'm not as young as I used to be. And that's exactly what M-Drive Start is designed for. M-Drive Start is a premium protein powder packed with seven clinically tested ingredients that support energy, strength, and drive, and six premium protein sources for optimal recovery and digestion. That's the one that's designed for me, but M-Drive has a supplement for every lifestyle and every stage of life. So there's one for you as well. M-Drive makes it easy for guys to take care of their health. Get M-Drive Start at mdriveformen.com. That's mdriveformen.com. And use coupon code BA2022, that's BA2022, for 10% off your first order of M-Drive. You get free shipping and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to mdriveformen.com and use order code BA2022.
Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is my colleague Joe Healy, and we are here to wrap up week nine of college baseball. It was an extended weekend, as it was Easter weekend as well. Happy Easter to those who celebrated over the weekend. And so that meant that many of these series opened on Thursday. So some of this stuff feels like low-key ancient history by now, Joe. But we've got a lot to get to. Around the country, you had so many teams in the top 25, like half of the top 25 lost series this weekend. So a lot of upsets, a lot of shakeups as a result to the top 25. One of the biggest ones was Virginia Tech beating Miami. Miami had been number two in the country. You had a big matchup in the Pac-12 with Stanford taking on UCLA. Big one in the Big 12 with TCU knocking off Texas Tech. Lots of stuff to get to in the ACC. We're going to try and get to it all here on today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. Joe, I don't know. We could start any number of places, but first, like, let's just reset where we are with the top 25 and how hard it was to put together 25 this week. If you look at it over at baseballamerica.com, the top 10 looks dramatically different than it was a week ago, and there were just so many upsets and just not upsets, but top 25 teams still losing just around the country. It was a challenge this week.
Yeah, I'm glad in a number of ways that it was the Easter weekend where most series go Thursday, Friday, Saturday, because it kind of gave, just speaking for myself, it kind of gave me time to process some of it before we kind of got down to brass tacks on Sunday and tried to put it together. Whereas in a typical week, if some of these series that involved ranked teams losing hadn't been decided until Sunday, and in some cases, you know, Sunday later in the day on the West Coast, it makes it really hard because we have to like scramble immediately into figuring out the top 25. And we might've been there until, you know, midnight doing so. So it was kind of nice that we had some time to kind of process and, look at all the information and then be able to do it. Put it together on Sunday, having had the information for a while, as opposed to kind of doing it almost in real time. But it was a carnage weekend. You know, what can you say? I mean, it just feels like that's kind of what we're dealing with this year outside of Tennessee, which got its first kind of scare, I guess, over the weekend. But it feels like the kind of season it's going to be at this point. And while that makes while that makes our jobs a little bit more difficult on Sunday, it does make it fun to follow and keeps blood pressure high for coaches around the country, which is another downside of it. But from start to finish, you could kind of see it coming that it was going to be one of these types of weekends.
Yeah, it started. I mean, you could even take it all the way back to Tuesday when Tennessee saw its 23 game winning streak snapped in a loss to Tennessee Tech in unique circumstances, as they were playing at the AA Tennessee Smokies ballpark and both teams were using wood bats, and Tennessee had like four hits and lost 3-2. So that was kind of just a weird start to the week. Then it carried over into Thursday. And I guess, Joe, let's start with one of the bigger results of Thursday that carried over almost in mirror image on Friday. And that's Virginia Tech knocking off Miami. Virginia Tech came out, scored a bunch of runs early, and just never looked back. And then they did it again on Friday, and Virginia Tech becomes the first team since Florida, the first weekend of March, to beat Miami. Miami had been coming off or had a 14 game winning streak of their own coming into the weekend. That obviously went away there on Thursday. Virginia Tech, meanwhile, hasn't lost a series now since the opening weekend of ACC play. The Hokies move into the top 25. They are number 11. This was a big result. Doesn't actually change anything materially in the ACC standings. Miami is still far and away in first place, thanks in part to things that happen around them. But it is a huge deal for Virginia Tech as they're trying to get to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2013. And this was a big step towards realizing that kind of potential, but also just planting a flag and saying that, you know, maybe you've been watching and hearing about how Virginia Tech's hitting all these home runs, but it's not just that. This team is more than just a home run derby every game. They are a really talented team, and they showed that this weekend against Miami.
Yeah, and they can do the home run derby thing, which is, I think, an asset in that. Look, I mean, we've seen this time and again in college baseball. If you have that kind of offense that can hit the ball out of the yard like that, it can be a little bit of a cheat code. It kind of gets you out of trouble. Now, it can also get you in some trouble if you get overly reliant on that. But at this point, this is a Virginia Tech offense that can score in a lot of ways. The home run is just a part of that. And it feels like the Hokies have been building to this weekend for a while. You mentioned, you know, losing a series to Georgia Tech back in about a month ago. But ever since then, they've kind of built up to it where they win a series against Pitt. And at the time, you know, Pitt wasn't playing all that well. And we kind of just were like, you know, and of course, now that one looks a little better. But then it had that series against Notre Dame where the last two games got canceled. Virginia Tech won one game in that weekend, but that ends up being kind of like a throwaway where we're just kind of like, okay, don't know what to make of that. Then they win a series on the road against North Carolina. Again, North Carolina starts to kind of crater a little bit. They're not as good as we thought they were back in early March or mid-March, what have you. So we start to maybe dismiss that a little bit. But, you know, last weekend they beat an NC State team that had been playing pretty well. And then, of course, this weekend they beat Miami, which is the crowning achievement so far this season. So the schedule was set up in such a way that it was going to take a little while for us to kind of take Virginia Tech seriously, because there was always kind of a reason why it made sense that maybe they could win that series and it doesn't have to mean something bigger about Virginia Tech. But those days are now over. Like, we certainly have to take them seriously, and we are. Obviously, the offense is the big thing here, and that is always going to be the case with this team. But, you know, the first 2 days of the weekend, at least, they also, with Griffin Green and Drew Hackenberg, like, I also like the 1-2 in the rotation. They pitched pretty well over the weekend, and you know, the depth is probably more of a concern on the mound for Virginia Tech, but that's a pretty good starting point when you can hit like they can and you have pitchers on the first 2 days like they have.
Yeah, Virginia Tech has the second most home runs in the country, trailing only Tennessee. They have the second best average as a team in the country, trailing only UNLV. They're scoring more than 9 runs a game. Everyone on this team basically can run the ball out of the ballpark. That's how you have the second most home runs in the country. They have 7 guys with an OPS north of 1,000. It's kind of insane when you look at the offensive numbers, but I think your point about the pitching is a really good, really important one. Green and Hackenberg both have been very consistent, very solid at the front of the rotation. Hackenberg is a freshman. You might be familiar with his older brothers. Christian played quarterback at Penn State, and Adam played baseball at Clemson. Drew now stepped right into the rotation. Statistically, he's arguably been Virginia Tech's best starter. And those two guys give them a chance. Those two guys combined with the offense give them a chance to match up really well with any team on a weekend. They clearly have a bit of a Sunday problem. They haven't won they haven't won a series finale in like a month. So that's a bit of a concern. I don't think it's a massive concern. Joe and I have talked numerous times about, well, how many teams really have a Sunday starter? How big a deal is it really? That's something that, like, as we get into the postseason, if that continues to be a problem for Virginia Tech, I mean, we'll take it more seriously then. For now, though, I'm willing to just say, like, look, this offense and those two starters make this a very formidable team. And Miami found that out in a big way this weekend. On the flip side of that, Joe, is that we've talked a lot about Miami's own 1-2 punch of Palmquist and Ligon and how good they can be and how good Miami's bullpen could be. This weekend, Virginia Tech really got to Palmquist and Ligon, and they all of a sudden Miami didn't really have any answer for that. They got punched in the face in those first two games early. And I mean, I'm not saying the game was over once Virginia Tech scored those early runs, but Miami fought back into it on Thursday. They didn't really on Friday. They never really got back into either one of those games, and just playing behind the eight ball all day was always going to be hard for them.
Yeah, and this was, you know, we didn't really preview this series. We debated it, and then ultimately didn't. And one of the things that we talked about offline was that if this was the old version of Miami, because, you know, we'd spent the last few weeks talking about, hey, this looks like a different Miami. They're just more consistent. They're winning on the road more than they normally do, even if winning games at home is always going to kind of be their thing. They're winning on the road a little more consistently. You know, they're not really, they don't seem as subject to the ups and downs. And then, you know, we kind of talked offline that, look, you know, if there was going to be a little bit of a let up, like this weekend was like a, you know, flashing red light that could happen here, because it's not just that Virginia Tech is clearly good. It's that they can demoralize you, which kind of seemed like maybe that's what happened those first 2 days when they put up 25 runs in two games. Although shouts to Miami for coming back and winning that third game. That's huge as a team looks to build in Miami's case, a top eight resume. Not getting swept is a huge part of that. But not only does Virginia Tech provide a particular challenge, but you're also going to Blacksburg, which is famously, first of all, a very different place than Coral Gables, but also just hard to get to. And it's going to be very different weather. And I didn't look at what the weather was, but I can guarantee you it was a little bit different than it was in Miami. And there's just a lot of things that go into that that made this weekend a little bit of a trap for Miami. And so I was kind of convinced that, I don't want to say Miami was above that, but just look, if they were going to be the team we'd seen the first 8 weeks of the season, they were going to be able to handle that. And they just, in this case, weren't. And I have to admit it, as good as I thought Virginia Tech was, especially offensively, I was a little bit surprised by that.
Well, okay, so here's one thing that maybe is becoming a situation, maybe isn't. And I am sorry, we're getting off track here. I watch games on replay as we do this podcast. I currently have Vanderbilt, Florida on, and they just showed Bill Belichick sitting in the stands in a Vanderbilt hat. And I am sure I am super late to the revelation that Bill Belichick was at one of these Vanderbilt, Florida games, but that happened, and you get to hear my live reaction to that.
Quickly on that, I is he not, maybe you couldn't see in that shot, is he not wearing like a puffy vest that on the chest has his name? Like he's got like his own like puffy vest with his name on it.
I'm rewinding.
All right. We can,
no, he's wearing like a blue chambray shirt.
Okay. Maybe the puffy vest was later. That being in the Tennessee press box this weekend meant that discussion of Vanderbilt was, you know, happening, and obviously they're paying attention to that kind of thing. So it did come up in the Tennessee press box this weekend, but it, to my eyes, it looked as if he was wearing a puffy vest at one point.
So I think that was his name on it. You were there on Friday. I'm pretty sure I'm watching the Saturday game. So that it must've been the night before that you heard that discussion. So I guess I missed this on two nights. I don't know how I missed it on Friday. Understandable that I missed it on Saturday, but I don't know how I missed this on Friday. Anyway, to go back to what I was saying, I have a slight concern about Miami moving forward. And right now I would characterize it just the way I said it. It's slight, but Carson Ligon has now given up 13 runs, 12 earned in 8 innings over the last 2 weeks, after giving up just 4 runs, 3 earned in 22 and a third over his first 4 ACC starts. Ligon had been this incredibly consistent starter, much the way that Drew Hackenberg as a freshman has been for Virginia Tech. Ligon, another freshman, had been that in that number 2 slot in Miami's rotation. Carson Palmquist is not a guy that Miami is asking to go deep into games for whatever reason. You know, we can talk about how he spent most of his career as a reliever before this, whatever. They're not asking it of him. And he has gone at least 6 innings just 3 times in 9 starts this season. And then Alejandro Rosario, who has moved into that third spot in Miami's rotation after being their opening day starter, has worked more than 5 innings just once this season. So all of a sudden, this Miami bullpen, which is very good, but they're being asked to carry an awful lot of this load. And if Ligon isn't able to correct here, I mean, Miami's pitching staff suddenly looks a little shakier. Now, the last 2 weeks they played Virginia and Virginia Tech, Virginia leads the nation in scoring. Virginia Tech is top 10. Like, runs were always going to happen. This was always going to be a difficult stretch for a freshman, especially. But I don't know. This is a bit of a concern for me as I look at Miami now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And it's kind of set up to just have to be that way, right? Unless they're going to start giving Palmquist more innings. But you would have thought if that was going to be the case, like, they would have
than halfway into the season.
Yeah, I mean, now is usually the kind of time when you're maybe looking to try to shave some innings off to maybe, you know, keep the workload from getting too heavy as the postseason approaches. But with a freshman like Ligon, you're always going to have to manage that workload. And it seems like they've made a choice. And I think it's a smart one, but it seems like they've kind of made a choice with Rosario on Sundays that they're going to have a very quick ripcord on him, you know, and try to keep his outings positive and keep them short. Because he's had good outings where he's thrown, like, maybe it was this past weekend, but like 4 1/3 where he gives up one run and then he's done. And so I think they're just being very quick with him. And so I think that's a choice they're making. So regardless, I think you're onto something there, where I think that is something to watch moving forward here does that start to hamper them a little bit more as the bullpen starts to get a little more exposure, both, you know, both in a good and bad way. That is certainly something to watch.
All right. So Virginia Tech, definitely a team to watch from here on out. They're hot and they have a chance this weekend to keep that momentum rolling at Boston College, which is the worst team in the ACC right now. However, Virginia Tech is just 5-5 away from home. So maybe a little bit tricky, but being able to go on the road at Boston College this weekend, follow this up would be a big deal for the Hokies. Miami, meanwhile, returns home to play Pitt, looking to get back on track. All right, Joe, let's head out west. UCLA and Stanford was one of the best series on paper coming into the weekend. It was a top 15 matchup between those two. Stanford comes away victorious here. The Cardinal win on Thursday night. Then UCLA comes back on Friday, the celebration of Jackie Robinson Day, notably, of course, a UCLA alum, and the Bruins play in a stadium named after Jackie Robinson. UCLA finds a way to win that game late. And then Stanford comes back, wins the series on Stanford Day on Saturday, going away. They really brought out the bats in that one. And the result is the Cardinal have a really significant series win coming out of Westwood.
Yeah, and it feels like Stanford is now really kind of hitting its stride. We had waited on it and waited on it, and there had been flashes. Obviously, the Round Rock weekend was a positive step, but we'd kind of waited for Stanford to take off running here. And it feels like maybe that's what's happening here. And part of the reason why it hadn't happened at this point probably is the schedule had been fairly tough. You know, they've already played Arizona, although, you know, now they're struggling. We'll talk about them in a little bit, but they've played Oregon State and now UCLA. So A lot of the tougher series are behind them, which
and
is
also
obviously
Oregon.
Good news.
They have played every Pac-12 contender, assuming like there are five teams within a game of each other at the top of the standings. Stanford has played them all. The next team is Arizona State, and I don't want to minimize what Sun Devils are. They're two games back. It just, you know, they're under 500 overall, and it just doesn't feel like they are on the same level as those five teams. But the four real contenders that it looks like right now, Stanford's already done with them.
Yeah. I mean, just so that's all good news for Stanford is that it feels like they're hitting their stride and also getting into a part of the schedule that's going to be a little more conducive to them ripping something impressive off here. The first and third games of the series were about as close to perfect games, not in a literal sense. I mean that in a they played about as well as you could possibly play, right? They get great outings in game one from Alex Williams, and then in the last game from Quinn Matthews, and the offense was good in both. And I think the biggest thing that I take from it is that we've been talking a decent amount about, you know, they're still waiting on Brock Jones to get going. They're still waiting on Drew Bowser, and both of those guys had good weekends. Drew Bowser hit a couple of home runs, had six total hits in the three games. Brock Jones had one massive game in the finale with two home runs and four RBI, but he also had two hits in the first game of the series. And so in stacking that on top of a pretty good weekend against Arizona State, like now maybe you're starting to see, you know, him being a little more impactful as opposed to just what he was before, which was, you know, taking some walks and doing, you know, doing things here and there, but was a little more inconsistent. Maybe now you start to see him emerge a little bit. It was also another good weekend for Braden Montgomery as he continues to kind of, you know, push back against the freshman wall in that sense. So not only are they, those things are related, right? I mean, the guys we thought that were going to be a big part of this are maybe coming in, rounding into form as Stanford as a team rounds into form. But look, if Stanford is going to, you know, get back to Omaha and challenge for national title, like they were eventually going to need those guys. And perhaps now we're seeing signs that those guys are on the way into getting into the form we expect them to have at the beginning of the season.
Stanford really liked hitting in Westwood this weekend. UCLA came in with the second best ERA in the country. Stanford added like about half a run, I think it was, to UCLA's ERA this weekend. It was a really impressive performance. Braden Montgomery, who had started the season so well as a freshman and, you know, gone through some up and downs as freshmen do, he absolutely loved hitting in Jackie Robinson Stadium. It seemed like he parked a couple of home runs onto the hitting structure behind right field there, just absolutely moonshots. And there were big home runs too on Thursday and Friday. And yeah, I mean, getting Brock Jones going, getting Drew Bowser going, these are going to be really big deals for Stanford. And so to do it against a UCLA pitching staff that is so good, especially to close it out in a big way on Saturday in a rubber game, I thought that was really significant. And the way that Quinn Matthews has stepped up again, I mean, he began the season as their number two starter, and then that kind of got out of whack because of how Stanford used him against Oregon State. And, you know, he's been pushed to the back of the rotation as a result of, you know, trying to get him. You know, they relieved him at the start of that series and then brought him back as a starter there in the third game. And so that's pushed him to the back of the rotation. And he's really taken to whatever role they put him in lately. And that's been a big part of why Stanford has been able to get right, I feel like. Because don't forget, I mean, they lost the first two series of Pac-12 play. Now, those were difficult series. It was Oregon and at Arizona, but they did lose those. And they've really been able to right the ship here. And, you know, like we mentioned, their series against the top contenders are over. They still have 4 weeks of Pac-12 play to go. But they have the benefit now of not having to play these other teams that seem like they're going to be competing with them for the Pac-12 title.
A thing that's both like a shortcoming and also they're in an advantaged position about right now is that the third game of the weekend, which right now is being started by Drew Dowd, is a big question mark. I mean, this past weekend against UCLA, he threw an inning and a third, and that has been kind of trending that way recently. Now, he has had good outings this season, you know, pitched actually pretty well against Oregon and Arizona early and really well against Washington State. And the last 3 weekends, though, have been a lot tougher for him. So that's the spot they need to kind of figure out. I mean, I think because they have Williams and Matthews pitching like they are, I think Stanford's actually a team that's in a really good position to win a super regional. But this is a team that it could have trouble closing out a regional right now, because you do need the third guy in a regional. Like, that's when that kind of comes up. And so it feels a little like, in terms of what Stanford's trying to do here. Go ahead.
I mean, you got to imagine that they would reset slightly going into that. And also, it shouldn't be lost that Stanford, their RPI jumped 21 spots last week, like with this sweep or the series win of UCLA, and they're in a hosting range now. Like, I will almost certainly have Stanford hosting this week. So
yeah. And like
four seed, you get to hold your one, you know, there are ways to massage this.
Yeah. You know, if the four seed is Grand Canyon though, you know, yeah, I mean, so
Grand
like
Canyon's not gonna be a four and you know it.
Well, I mean, you're probably right, but like, it's just point being like they've got about a month to try to figure out what they want to do with that. It, you know, and they've had some success at various times kind of doing a team day on the mound. And maybe that is the way forward. I don't know, but largely they've got about a month here to kind of figure out what they want to do on that third day and how they want to approach that. And it feels like that is kind of a little bit of a dangling question for them as they move forward, because you know, that could be a place where they're a little bit vulnerable on the mound.
The other thing about Stanford with this, before we touch on UCLA here, is that Joe, you've noted, I don't think you've noted on the podcast, maybe you did, but certainly offline, that they just haven't played midweek games. And so not only do they not maybe have a third starter, they don't really have a fourth starter either. So I would be fascinated to see what they would do. The Pac-12 tournament is probably going to be revealing in some ways, although Dave Esker has never coached in a conference tournament. So I have no idea how he would approach it, how he will approach it. So a lot to be learned here down the stretch about Stanford. It's a very important point, and I think probably makes, you know, Stanford their need is strong, but that they would really want to host, I would think, just so you can get out of a 2-3 game on that first day.
Yeah, I mean, it will also be related to the idea that Coach Esker has not coached in a conference tournament situation. You know, I'd be curious. This is something I could research and go back and look at. Although, you know, they weren't hosting at Cal when he got them to regionals. It's really just been since he's at Stanford that he's been hosting. But I'd be curious to go back and look at how they've played regionals, because, you know, I would wonder if he's the kind of guy that throws an ace on Friday regardless of the opponent. So, you know, that's something I could obviously research and look at. And I wish I'd done that before we started recording here, but something to look at there, because if they do play that straight up, obviously you throw that out. But that, of course, is one of the infinitely interesting things about regional weekend, is it does, for host teams, it does create, based on who your four is and the way you like to approach regionals, it does give you an interesting question to answer about how you want to approach your pitching.
So on UCLA here, losing on Sunday or Saturday the way that they did, that's tough. We know right now, or you know, we've talked about how without you know, they're trying to figure the third spot out following Thatcher Hurd's injury. Looks like they're still working through that, and it's just kind of shocking to see UCLA give up 11 runs. I don't want to make too much out of this weekend. UCLA has played some really tough teams. They've played them well, and you know, they lost on Saturday, and so therefore they lose this series. But I don't think anything materially changed for UCLA, except that I mentioned that Stanford made a big RPI move. This would have been an opportunity for UCLA to do the same. Instead, they fall. They're currently 51, and that's bad. And you know, for a West Coast team, it's not a problem for making a regional. It might get UCLA seated as a three. If it doesn't improve, I would expect it to improve. But I think it is going to be really hard to have a home regional if you're UCLA now, unless they just basically intend on not losing the rest of the season. So that might have gone out the window this weekend. We'll see. But it does seem like a bit of a missed opportunity here for the Bruins.
No doubt. And it showed, you know, while it is shocking to see them allow 9 and 11 runs in a couple of games this weekend, they also didn't score in those games. I mean, Stanford could have scored 3-2 runs, and that would have been the same outcome. So it did show that against good pitching, which Stanford has at least two of those guys that would qualify as is top line pitching. That's just kind of the risk that UCLA is going to run this season, is they can get beat in games like that, that are low scoring. And as we know, if you depress the score, it does increase the level of variability in the outcome.
Yeah, just 8 runs on the weekend for UCLA. That is not good. They won another one run game, though. They are.
Yeah, they got that figured out.
Do not play a one run game against UCLA. Yeah. You will lose. You gotta find a way to get a slight bit of separation there. All right, plenty more to talk about around the country. I guess before we do that, Joe, like, let's quickly touch on the rest of the Pac-12. Arizona lost again, and they lost at Utah, and there's not a whole lot of shame in that. Joe and I have been talking about Utah's drive for 8 borrowing. You're referencing the solid verbal when you say that, right, Joe?
Yes, as it turns out, I actually couldn't remember where that was from. But yes, I guess I am. I guess that is what that's from.
Yeah, that's their drive for 6, which is, of course, bowl eligibility. Utah's drive for 8, when we talk about that, which we're now introducing here. This has not been a previously part of the podcast, but I'm bringing it to the podcast, Joe. Drive for 8 would be Utah trying to qualify for the Pac-12 tournament, which would be a pretty significant step for a program that hasn't finished 8th more than I think once, and that was the year they won the Pac-12s. They've been in the Pac-12 for about a decade now.
I did look it up, actually, that it would have been twice. So it was the year they won the title, and the next year they were still pretty good, but it was like 4th or 5th in the Pac-12.
Yeah, so like twice in 10 years. So it would be a significant deal for Utah to qualify for the Pac-12 tournament, and it looks like they might. Like, they are a legitimately solid team, and they're giving good teams problems. And this weekend, they won a series against Arizona, and that on itself wouldn't be that big a deal. However, Arizona has now lost back-to-back Pac-12 series against Washington State and Utah. And Washington State is the last place team in the Pac-12, and Utah is 8th. And, you know, Arizona is now in the same mess at the top of the standings that everyone else is in. And unfortunately for Arizona, they now have missed 2 pretty great opportunities to create a little bit of separation. If they just win both of those series, I'm not talking about sweeping, just talking about them adding 2 wins. I mean, they would be alone at the top of the Pac-12 and everyone would be having to chase Arizona. Instead, they're in the mess with everyone else. They've seen their RPI slip all the way to 47. This was a team that was in the top 10. 2 weeks ago. Hosting is again probably out the window for this team at this point, unless they're going to completely turn things around. So it's just a weird spot, because the other thing, Joe, is that Oregon State, Stanford, they're surging. UCLA is coming off of this tough series loss to Stanford, but has played pretty well. That was their first series loss since opening weekend of Pac-12 play. And meanwhile, Arizona's hit a midseason skid against what should have been an advantageous part of their schedule.
Yeah, I mean, they should be winning the Pac-12 right now, you know, and they should be a couple games clear, probably. I say should, you know, obviously we...
I mean, they should be a game and a half clear. 2 more wins would mean they'd be a game and a half clear at the top of the Pac-12. And obviously you can feel like maybe one of those should have been a sweep.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have. Yeah. You make me guess. I say they go 5-1 in those 2 series. You know, the Utah series was on the road. So, okay, let's give Utah a game there. Yeah, but you would have expected them to sweep Washington State at home. Just a tough section of schedule there. I mean, and it's some of the things that we've been talking about the last few weeks with Arizona. When we have talked about them, it's the offense pretty top heavy at this point. Guys like Noah Turley and Chase Davis have fallen off as conference play has gotten going. You know, they got a guy like Tony Bullard back healthy, but he hasn't, you know, been doing it offensively, and Tyler Casagrande hasn't stepped up. So you've got, you know, Susak and Tanner Otrimba and Mac Bingham swinging it pretty well, but that's about it really. And then on the mound, you know, you felt pretty good about TJ Nichols and Garrett Irvin, and, you know, and Garrett Irvin still kind of does his thing. Like, he kind of is who he is. Like, he's going to get got periodically because his stuff isn't great. So if he's not locating or what have you, you know, he's going to get hit a little bit. But TJ Nichols has given up 16 runs in his last three starts. And so he's gone from a month ago looking like, hey, you know, this guy, if he finishes like he started, he could be the Pac-12 pitcher of the year. That has fallen off and he just hasn't been as effective. And this was always going to be an offense first team. So at least when you had those two guys at the front of the rotation, plus, you know, a Trevor Long and a Quinn Flanagan in the bullpen, you felt like, okay, we've got, you know, four, maybe five guys here, if you throw in a couple of others, that we feel really, really good about. And that has, at least on the starting side, has lagged a little bit over the last few weekends.
Quickly, Joe, who's winning the Pac-12?
Let me pull it up. Oregon State. Let's go Oregon State. Without looking at the schedules, I mean, they've just been, it feels like one of the more consistent teams there. Again, I don't know what the schedule looks like necessarily by heart, but I've got a little bit of trust there. Their offense really hasn't lagged. I mean, that's the best thing that they've got going for them. Even with the pitching injuries, the offense has always held up its end of the bargain. They're getting a little bit healthier on the mound. So that is helpful. So let's go with Oregon State. Kudos to Oregon, though, by the way, just doing what they're doing, because speaking of injuries, like, it has not been easy for Oregon. And there are a lot of teams that we've talked about the injury bug and fighting through injuries and maybe cutting them some slack, and understandably so. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but Oregon's kind of the counter to that, which is like, they just keep winning games, even though it hasn't been easy. And like, you know, they're not getting great starting pitching, but they're just figuring it out. So kudos to Oregon. I don't know how sustainable this is going to be, but they've already advanced further at the top of the Pac-12 than I thought they would, given some of the struggles they've had.
Yeah, you and I keep saying, like, I don't know how sustainable this is for Oregon, and I'm kind of getting to the point where it's like, you know what, maybe they just could do this. And, you know, they're still missing their opening day starter, Adam Mayer, and not expected back. And, you know, not expected back anytime soon. I don't think they've officially ruled him out. But, I mean, they're right there with everyone else, and they have a top 10 RPI, and, you know, it's remarkable. I like you, though. I think I would have to go with the Beavers, but I don't want to rule Stanford out right now. The way that they're playing and the fact that they've already, you know, got the 11 wins on the board, and still have, you know, and have already gotten done with the top contenders. They're the only one of the top contenders that can say that. So I think it's going to come down to those two, as we thought it would coming into the year. Stanford does have the tiebreaker already. So potentially you could talk me into the Cardinals for sure, but I would probably also lean Beavers right now. Fascinating race to follow as we hit the stretch run. All right, so plenty more to get to around the country. We're going to do that here in a second, but first, check this out.
As someone who's in charge of hiring at Baseball America, I know how important it is to find the right people for the right jobs. A few months ago, we had a couple of Baseball America staffers who took jobs with other companies, and that meant that we needed to find quality people to replace them quickly. And for the first time, we decided to use Indeed, and I have to say that the entire process was so much easier because we used Indeed. Indeed matched us up with quality candidates and made the entire process much more pleasurable than previous hirings have been for me. If you're hiring, you need Indeed, because Indeed is the hiring partner where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Indeed is the only job site where you're guaranteed to find quality applicants who will meet your must-have requirements, and if they don't, you don't pay. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites hoping to find candidates with the right skills, you need one hiring partner who can help you do it all. Indeed partners with you on every step of the hiring process. You can find great talent through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a short list of quality candidates with resumes already on Indeed that match your job description, and you can invite them to apply right away. Plus, you only pay for the quality applicants that meet your must-have requirements. Indeed reduces significantly the amount of time that I needed to spend to find the right candidates. Everything was in one spot and was set up in a way that was easy to use. Indeed also handled a lot of the administrative tasks that took up a lot of time for me when doing hirings in the past. You can start hiring right now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at indeed.com/baseballamerica. This offer is valid through April 30th. And reminder, candidates you invite to apply through Instant Match are three times more likely to apply to your job than candidates who only see it through search. Indeed is the number one job site in the world with more total visits than any other job site, according to ComScore. So get all the benefits of using Indeed. Go to Indeed.com/baseballamerica to claim your $75 credit before April 30th. That's Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. If you love to play poker, now you don't have to get the whole game together to get the whole game together to play poker. With Poker Chill, you can play poker with your friends, even if they're in another state or halfway around the world. Poker Chill lets you play poker with your friends with built-in video chat. And don't worry, this doesn't mean you're going to be tethered to your computer all night. You can play on your iPhone or iPad. Web and Android versions are coming soon as well. It's easy to use. You get set up in just three taps for beginners, although there are custom controls for more advanced games. And there's high-quality video chat built right into the game. It's as fun and real as live poker, but from your phone. Get started by downloading the Poker Chill app. That's Poker, C-H-I-L-L. Your first 2 hours are free, so check it out now.
All right, Joe, let's pick things back up where you were this weekend, and that was in Knoxville. Sorry to your one day in Cookeville. I don't think we're going to get to Tennessee Tech and SEMO here, but let's talk about the Vols. Tennessee was playing Alabama. Mentioned at the top of this that they lost on Tuesday to Tennessee Tech, ending their 23-game winning streak. They still came into the weekend, however, with a 12-game SEC winning streak. Unprecedented start to SEC play in conference history. And then Alabama messed that up as well for them on Friday, as the Tide become the first SEC team to beat Tennessee. Tennessee comes back, wins the next two games of the series. Saturday had a lot of fireworks. Three coaches were ejected, including Tennessee head coach Tony Vitello. That was in the first inning. But Tennessee, unbothered, went on and won the next 2 days and won the series and remains number one. Not a whole lot we haven't said about Tennessee to this point. They overcame another poor start by Chase Burns. They didn't actually win the game, but they overcome it. You know, it doesn't ruin the weekend. I guess what are your overall takeaways having been in Tennessee this weekend?
I think there was value in seeing Tennessee not just have close calls, because they had close calls last weekend against Missouri. And I wrote after the opener of the series that Missouri walked so that Alabama could run, because Missouri came close three times. And Thursday or Friday's opener, I keep getting mixed up because of the different days, but Friday's opener was very similar to the games Missouri played against Tennessee. And Alabama was just able to get it done, whereas Missouri couldn't. And so, but I thought it was valuable to see Tennessee deal with that adversity. And I kind of thought, you know, early in Saturday's game, when Dolander gets hit with the line drive, and then you have, you know, Frank Anderson and Tony Vitello ejected within 30 seconds of each other, I kind of had a thought. And oh, by the way, like Dolander is clearly in pain, and they send Camden Sewell down to the bullpen to warm up, which signaled that, hey, like, we don't think Dolander is coming back. I kind of had a thought of like, well, this weekend might just kind of like really get away from them, because Alabama had hit the ball pretty well on Friday, not just against Chase Burns, but generally they were making pretty good contact. Like, they were having good at bats.
And of course, this is an Alabama team that just swept Ole Miss in Oxford a week ago.
Yeah. I mean, this is, and the feeling around Tennessee, just talking to like the guys who cover that team day by day, that their feeling was that, you know, this was the best team that Alabama was going to be the best team that Tennessee had seen, at least at home. And I think that's right. I mean, Alabama is just a very solid team. And I come out of the weekend still thinking that team that just kind of knows who they are and really even keeled about it, which is a hard thing when you go into Tennessee and there's all the emotion and the noise and the, all of it. It's a hard thing to kind of to stay that way in Knoxville. And they did it with the win to start the series anyway. So that, I think there was value in that, seeing that from Tennessee, and certainly their answer the last 2 days was emphatic. The offense came alive. They got, you know, good offensive days from a lot of guys, ranging from, you know, Jordan Beck with a 2-home run game to Jorel Ortega had a big weekend. They got a little bit from a lot of different guys, and that has been the Tennessee way this year. It will be interesting to see what they do on the mound moving forward. in a few different regards. First of all, shout out Wes Rucker 247. I saw him tweet yesterday that it was pretty vague, but he just said, you know, from what I understand, the Dolander injury is not as bad as it could be. I don't exactly know what that means, but it does sound to me like he will return. Maybe it'll be some time. That's kind of my read on that. However, he's been very good for them. So that does kind of create a hole. And then also, you know, this is two weekends in a row where Chase Burns has really struggled on Fridays. And, you know, he's another freshman who could be getting to that point where he's having to break through a freshman wall. And he's been good enough and his stuff is good enough. They're going to want him to continue to be a part of a mix, right? Like they want him to be a guy for them in a regional, super regional, and potentially in Omaha. So they've got to kind of figure out how to manage that. Like, I'm not saying they're going to just, you know, bury him at this point, but you do have to start asking, do you move him back in the rotation? Maybe the Dolander injury is an opportunity to slide him back a day or a couple of days, move Drew Beam up. Drew Beam continues to pitch pretty well. There's that. Blade Tidwell has thrown a little more. He's not really been stretched out, but are you going to eventually move him back into the rotation at some point? If you're Tennessee, maybe this is an opportunity to do that. The injury to Dolander plus Burns' struggles, like, seems like that might be an opportunity to try that and see how that goes. So that's going to be the thing to watch for Tennessee, especially given that this is a team that just answered every question they've been presented with so far. So, you know, you kind of run out of ways to kind of continue to talk about it, but this is kind of an interesting wrinkle they haven't necessarily had to deal with. And they've obviously fought through it this weekend, but there are definitely some questions on the mound that they're going to have to contend with as they move forward.
The fact that Tidwell is running around potentially ready to take on a bigger role, or at least take on more innings, makes that it's a huge deal for Tennessee going through something like this. The challenge for Tennessee, though, is that they're dealing with Burns now being coming off of back-to-back short starts, and Dolander at the same time, because to move Beam up 2 days would be challenging. I think you would have to know going into this weekend in Florida that, you know, he's not going to be able to go as deep into games as he has been. If you're taking 2 days of rest away from him, you know, you would like to make that move more gradual. So, you know, maybe that's, you move him up a day. If Dolander can't go this weekend, you move him up a day and you TBD Sunday, and you hope that you can hold Tidwell back and then see what he can give you, and then let the rest of your really talented bullpen do the job the rest of the way. I don't know. There are a lot of ways to go about it. And with the uncertainty of Dolander right now, completely impossible for us to know how it'll go. But this always was going to be a big weekend against Florida. Even if the Gators have been struggling at times this year, going down to Gainesville is not easy. And now dealing with what they're dealing with, and also Tony Vitello will be suspended for the first two games of that Florida series because he was ejected because he made contact with an umpire. That triggers a 4-game suspension. He served the first of that in the finale. They play Bellarmine midweek, and then he'll have 2 games suspended at Florida. So just a lot going on there this weekend, a lot of decisions to work through for Tennessee. Flip side, Joe, Alabama, made a lot of noise a week ago when they swept Ole Miss, made some more noise on Thursday, clearly is a better team than what they were last year. And that team made regionals. What, I don't want to say what's the ceiling, but, you know, where do you see Bama going from here now?
I think it's a good, not great team. Like it's a good team, I think, that is kind of playing at the top of its what it can be right now, but is clearly a step back from the best in the SEC. I think they, because the SEC has been a little bit convoluted and a little bit bunched up in the middle, I think they've been able to take advantage of that a little bit. And look, you come out of road series against Ole Miss and Tennessee going 4-2, kind of regardless of how that shook out, like, you'll take that. And so they will head back home, understanding they did a good job getting through these last couple weeks in the way that they did. My concern with them is that I just don't know Well, I'll start with what I really like. I think it's a pretty good offense, like 1 through 9. They've got a lot of guys who do a lot of different things. If they could get Owen Diodati going, he hit a couple home runs the first game of the series, and then the last two games he went 0 for 7. That has kind of been the Owen Diodati experience at Alabama. So that would be a big thing. I really like Zane Denton. He's, you know, somebody that the Tennessee coaching staff, Josh Elander specifically, called out in postgame after the game on Saturday as just a really good hitter. So I like him. Jim Jarvis is kind of a fun player at the front of the lineup. So I do like their lineup kind of 1 through 9. It's a lineup without a superstar, I would say, unless you want to define Zane Denton that way. So I like that. I do like some of the looks they give you in the bullpen. Hunter Hoops is an interesting guy. Brock Guffey, the lefty from a low slot. My concern, though, is that I just don't know if they have enough stuff on the mound, right? And this is the problem we've talked about before. This is the where Connor Prelip would have helped. Because, you know, they've got basically three, you know, kind of pitchability guys. And Grayson Hitt, I think, maybe has a touch more stuff there. But, you know, the first days with McMillan and McNary, it's not a lot of stuff. And McMillan is just a really gutsy guy who's done a really nice job on Fridays, has actually turned himself into something approaching a dude on Friday nights in the SEC. And he did it again this past Friday, gutting it out. But McNary got hit around pretty good the second game. And then Grayson Hitt really got hit around in the finale. And so they just have to kind of survive some of those starts and win games a different way. But that's kind of my concern, is that I just don't know if there's enough stuff in the rotation for them to consistently win games once they get into a postseason where you're just going to be facing mostly good offenses the rest of the way.
We will see where Alabama goes from here. I feel like they've made some strides already in season. I watched a lot of their series against Texas early on, and it does seem like they're an improved team from there. So we'll see what they can do now over the final 5-6 weeks here before the postseason begins. Elsewhere in the SEC, A&M went to Georgia and won a series. Arkansas swept LSU. South Carolina beat Ole Miss. That was a big deal for the Gamecocks, also a big deal for the Rebs. Mississippi State got a series win against Auburn. That was huge for the Bulldogs. Vanderbilt beat Florida. That was a pretty big deal for both of those programs. None of that was really like earth shattering. I would say the A&M series win was maybe the biggest deal of it all. For me, A&M looking very good to make the postseason at this point. Georgia clearly fighting it on the mound. They again did not have Jonathan Cannon, and they're very clearly just short right now. Getting Cannon back, which I believe the hope is maybe next week against Alabama. That would be a really big deal for Georgia. But what stood out to you, Joe?
I thought Arkansas sweeping LSU was impressive because, you know, Arkansas just kind of continues to be like a snake in the grass. And I think some of the reason why we overlook them is just it still doesn't really feel like they are fully operational, right?
I would say they do to me feel a little fully operational. They just haven't really played any massive series because this one could have been, it was a top 25 series, but they just took care of business so quietly. And, you know, they got upset once last week by Florida, but they just go about their business and they do their thing. You know, unlike some other teams, you know, they don't have the flashy, splashy numbers or the, you know, Connor Noland is a really nice Friday starter, but he's not, you know, he's not a guy we're talking about as a potential first round or anything. So they just, the way that they're built, they're just able to kind of go under the radar unless they were going to start hitting a bunch of home runs. And to this point, I think that's what you're talking about, not being fully operational. And I mean, we've said it many times at this point in the season, kind of are what you are. And right now, Arkansas doesn't seem like that kind of team, but they're still a really, really good one.
Yeah, it's a shame that we're not going to get a Tennessee Arkansas in the regular season. But hopefully, I hope for your sake, when you're in Hoover, that you get a matchup there, because not only are those two very good teams, but those are two teams that are going to very much be there for the smoke, as they say. But yeah, that was an impressive sweep. Arkansas continues to show that, hey, they're a better team on the mound. It was a bounce back start for Hagan Smith in the rotation. So that was good there. And offensively, like, a couple things stand out to me. One is, again, we've said this before, where would this team be without transfers and Chris Lanzilli and Michael Turner, like two of their better hitters all season long. So that the transfer portal has come in clutch for Arkansas in the lineup. Brady Slavin's also swinging the bat a little bit better as of late. He was a guy who was under 200 as of when they played Missouri. So he has come on. That is helpful. He's a guy they're just frankly going to need. And part of the reason why they just need him is, you pointed this out to me, not a lot of depth offensively for Arkansas. They're kind of the opposite of Tennessee, where, you know, Tennessee has guys on the bench that, you know, if this were professional baseball, they could trade for a whole bunch of prospects because they are ready for prime time and just don't, you know, guys like Christian Moore and Blake Burke, like, just, there just aren't at bats for them. Arkansas is kind of in another place where they just don't, their guys are their guys, and they're just going to run those guys out there. And it's worked to this point. And having a guy like Slavin's getting going is certainly helpful.
Yeah. Arkansas's played like 11 dudes, like literally.
Yeah.
it's remarkable. Ole Miss losing to South Carolina, Joe, it kind of defies logic here that Ole Miss has put themselves in the situation that they're in, but they're now 5-10 in the SEC. No one has a worse record than Ole Miss. Mizzou and Kentucky also are 5-10, but no one has less SEC wins than Ole Miss. I mean, like, you have to press the panic button now, right? If you're one of the Ole Miss fans that hadn't done it already, I mean, like, this is the time, right?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Because, like, good luck making up ground. Like, even if we're going to concede that, like, the squishy middle of the SEC is apparent this year, like, well, I mean, it's so hard to claw back in the SEC. And they've got a schedule that, like, look, you can squint your eyes hard enough. I mean, they've still got, you know, series against Missouri and Texas A&M.
I mean, they play Mississippi State, like, at home this weekend. If they are serious about making the postseason, they have to win this weekend. There is no way. There's not no path, because there's always a path for an SEC team, but there is basically no path if they don't win the rivalry series this weekend. They need 8 wins at least from now until the end of Hoover, and they probably need more like 9 or 10 from now until the end of Hoover. And I don't know how you get that if you don't pick up the home week, if you don't win your home weekends.
Yeah, that is key. But yes, the panic button has been pressed. And I think, you know, fans of that program probably pressed it a lot sooner than you and I did, frankly. There's a lot of, you know, nobody needs us to say this, but, like, it's a big season in Oxford for a lot of reasons in terms of, you know, needing to get this turned around.
Yeah, it's just very strange to see this weekend, you know, Ole Miss and Mississippi State are playing, and that's very exciting. Love that rivalry. But it's not for first place in the SEC West. It's for last place in the SEC West. Last thing before we move on from the SEC, Joe, other side of the Magnolia State, Mississippi State beats Auburn. You know, Mississippi State has a lot more RPI work to do than Ole Miss. Like, they not only need wins, they need RPI to improve, and as you win games in the SEC, that naturally happens. So they're going to shake each other's hand on that. But it was still a big deal for them to go out, win this series against Auburn. I thought it was pretty gutty the way that they did it. On the flip side, good on Auburn for making sure they didn't get swept. And they still are tied for second in the SEC West. So anything Auburn had on the table last week, I feel, is still there. I wouldn't project them as a host right now. I did a week ago, but it was not catastrophic that they went to Starkville and lost a series.
Yeah, no doubt. And salvaging, again, big. If you're going to host or whatever you want to do in the SEC, not getting swept is huge. This is always going to be a tough weekend. For one, I just think the idea that Mississippi State was just going to kind of go quietly into the night the rest of the season, despite their shortcomings, like, I don't think that was ever going to happen. And then also, this was Super Bulldog weekend. That's always a tough weekend. in Starkville, even in years when Mississippi State isn't particularly good. So that was always going to be a tough one for Auburn. So getting out of it with a win, I think they will certainly take that.
Alrighty. We had a top 20 ACC matchup in Tallahassee. Louisville went down there, played Florida State, and got swept. Florida State with a huge get right week. They beat Florida on Tuesday. They sweep Louisville on the weekend. It was absolutely what the Noles needed. We probably should have gotten it to this way earlier in the podcast. But on the other hand, these games just weren't close. Florida State controlled it the whole weekend. And, it was the kind of series that I expected to watch a lot of and wound up watching almost none of.
Yeah, the ACC never really short on just wackiness in the ACC. Like, I just, it's not exactly the same conference as last year because the quality is better, and because of a lot of different reasons, like they're going to be in a better position in the postseason they were last year. But it is the same conference as last year in that, you know, by the time we get to this time of year, with the exception of like, sorry, BC, with the exception of like BC, I would believe basically any result, you could pick two teams out of a hat and then put them randomly at who is home and who is away. And I would still believe just about any result in the ACC. Now, that is not necessarily a commentary on this series, although I guess it is. because I, you know, even at home, I would not have expected Florida State to sweep this series, but that is where we're at in the ACC. And you're right that for the most part, it was just controlled. I mean, the finale looks close. Four late runs for Louisville. So I guess it was close. It's 10-9, but that was controlled for seven innings by Florida State until Louisville made it interesting late. So there is that there. But yeah, it was a return to form for Florida State. It kind of shows that anybody who was super worried about the pitching and thought maybe that the ground was shifting underneath the rotation for Florida State, that was a little bit premature, even if the third spot is a concern at this point. I think we can say that with 100% certainty, but at least in the first two spots in the rotation with Messick and Hubbard, it was a return to form. And look, that's just going to be the formula for Florida State moving forward. This was absolutely massive.
On the flip side, Louisville has now lost two of its last three series. They're really struggling away from home. Ultimately, like there's really no way around that. Seen that from Louisville before, certainly, but definitely is the case this year. Their RPI fell all the way to 43. They're still in first place in the division, there's no separation. There are five teams in that division within a game of each other. So absolutely no separation at all. The fact that they're in first place now doesn't really mean a whole lot of anything. I don't know what to make of this team anymore. We talked last week about how they could have lost the series very easily to North Carolina, at which point they would have lost three straight ACC series. To their credit, they didn't. But the team that beat or that swept Notre Dame a month ago now, I don't know what happened to it. And look, it's possible that Notre Dame just also isn't that good. Notre Dame, on the other hand, swept Florida State in Tallahassee 2 weeks ago. On the other hand, Notre Dame also was just swept at Duke. Like, I don't know what to make of anything in the ACC, but I don't know what to make of Louisville right now. They've got a big weekend at home against North Carolina State. They have a big week period. They have Kentucky and then North Carolina State all at home. They're going to need a bounce back the way that Florida State got a bounce back this week.
Agreed. And it, you know, some of the old bugaboos that I kind of questioned when I saw Louisville early this season that they had shored up for a while have now kind of come back around. They didn't play particularly good defense over the weekend, particularly in the game that poor Jared Poland started, where he gave up six runs, all of them unearned. Now, he also gave up six hits and three walks. So it's not like it was, you know, he was just cruising, but, you know, six unearned runs against Jared Poland in a game where, you know, Florida State ends up scoring nine runs. If you take those unearned runs off the board, I know it's not that simple, but in theory, Louisville wins that game. So the defense was not super clean. And then also, you know, in a related note, the starting pitching has started to slip again. You know, they went to Caleb Corbett instead of Tate Keener this time around. It did not go particularly well for for Corbin in that start. We talked about Poland and then Riley Phillips, an inning and a third in the finale. And so that looked like it had been a short up unit. It looked like, frankly, Poland was one of the better stories in college baseball, a guy who's just been so up and down for the Cardinals in his career, finally maybe figuring it out. And maybe that's still the case, but it has not been easy the last few weeks. And so those things that I was concerned about in Louisville in week one that looked like had gotten a little bit better have now started to backslide a little bit, and water seems to be finding its level.
RPI down to 43. It's going to be really hard to host. Not impossible. They have a way that they still go on the road to play Vanderbilt, Wake Forest, and Virginia Tech. They also still play Virginia. All of those are really high RPI teams, and you win those games and your RPI is going to shoot back up. But on the other hand, they're high RPI teams for a reason. So a challenging road if Louisville wants to play at home this postseason. And again, Louisville is now 6-7 away from Jim Patterson Stadium. Hard to feel confident about Louisville if they're not playing at home. So Joe, we talked about Louisville and Arizona and their tough series losses. Texas lost a series at Kansas State. Notre Dame, I just mentioned, was swept at Duke. Who are we concerned about the most here? None of this is good. Texas is now 500 in the Big 12. Still have a great RPI. Still have a real chance to host. But like on the other hand, K-State was 1-8 in the Big 12 coming into this weekend. Notre Dame has the RPI to host, much like Texas. They're top 10 in the RPI, but they're 8-7 in conference play. And I just have these couple really weird weekends in which they got swept at Louisville and at Duke. Arizona, we talked about. Louisville, we talked about. Who are we most concerned about here, I guess?
Well, so I guess my answer is Notre Dame. And if I could talk through it real quick, like maybe because I think my answer is Notre Dame. Maybe by the time I talk this out, I'll feel differently because I think it's kind of two different cases. Texas feels a little to me like last year's Florida, right? Where they come in number one in the country, where Florida was, basically there was no other option last year. It was obviously Florida. We felt pretty similarly about Texas this year. And Florida last year, just from the jump, Texas looked really strong first 3 weeks and then injuries happened. Maybe that's the key difference there. But Florida from the jump last year just clearly was not as good as we thought they would be. Texas took a little longer and again, took maybe some injuries. I mean, let's just be Tanner Witt injury. When we say injuries, like that's really what we're talking about there with Texas is Tanner Witt's injury. But, I don't want to dismiss Austin Todd being out for a while, but like that's the big one. So they've kind of had these struggles and they just haven't been as good as we expected. They haven't been putting teams away. Series just haven't been easy. But yet, you mentioned the RPI is still right there. Like it still feels like a team that's going to find their way to hosting, even if it's kind of uninspiring and we're just kind of like, and we wouldn't be shocked if maybe they just get upset in a regional, right? The thing with Notre Dame though, that I say I'm a little bit more concerned about is it feels like some of the things that we were somewhat quick to just kind of dismiss maybe is too strong a word. But the end of last year, we kind of quickly said, well, they don't have Nico Cavadas in the lineup. And like, that's a big deal, but they return basically everybody else. Maybe they'll be a little more dynamic offensively. But now you look at it and they're not really any more dynamic. Like they've stolen 39 bases. Okay. But their on base percentage isn't like pushing over 400 to where they've got a lot of traffic, and they've lost that element in the lineup of being able to hit a 3-run home run. And so like, maybe that was a bigger loss than I was willing to admit at the time. And then on the flip side, first off, shout out to John Michael Bertrand, who is a guy who has gone from like last year being like, yeah, he throws strikes and he competes and like, basically talking around the fact that like his stuff isn't great and he kind of just gets the job. Like this year he's become like a real guy. So like shout out there. But, last year they were using 5 or 6 guys and it kind of feels like slowly but surely at the start of the season, it looked like they had found some additional depth on the mound and that they were going to be working with a little bit more in that regard. like here they are back to kind of feeling like they're just a couple of guys short on the mound, and they made that work last year. And maybe they figure it out again as time goes on, but it does seem like an area where they're a little bit vulnerable is if they're just kind of rolling out the same guys week after week.
So I'm most concerned about Arizona. The thing about Texas and Notre Dame, and your points are mostly ones that I would agree with.
Well, to be fair, yes, out of the three,
checked out on Arizona.
We already talked about Arizona, so I kind of moved on from Arizona. I also would give you the Arizona answer because, like, yes, they lost to Utah and Wazoo. But yes, please continue.
Yeah, so I mean, my thing with Texas, and like we can just move on from Arizona. We did talk about them, but Louisville is in a similar boat here. Those two teams have really hurt their RPIs over the last 2 weeks. I'm much more concerned about Arizona's RPI than Louisville because, as I laid out, Louisville has these games against difficult competition. They're going to have to win them, but in the ACC, you're just better set up to have RPI success than you are in the Pac-12. But both of those teams are really struggling away from home. I'm not here to say, obviously Notre Dame is as well. And Texas hasn't been amazing away from home either. All three of Texas's series losses notably have been on the road. So these are all teams that it sure seems like they need to play at home in the postseason if they're going to be serious about doing anything here. I mean, the teams with top 10 RPIs, like, I'm just going to trust that they win enough games to make that work. And you know, if they keep slipping, they'll lose those RPIs, and then that'll be a different situation. But right now, I think that both of those can salvage it so that they can host. I don't see them getting upset at home in regionals, though Texas, if they do host, is sure to have a very challenging field. Come to Austin, starting with the fact that Texas State is almost guaranteed to be in their regional, and we know that the Bobcats are a pretty good team. Notre Dame's not going to necessarily have an easy regional either. But right now, I feel better about those teams because I feel better about them hosting. Louisville, their entire hosting case basically is, hey, we swept Notre Dame. At some point, that's not going to be enough anymore. And that point is rapidly approaching. They're going to have to win games down the stretch. They're going to have to play better away from home if they're going to do this. And I just don't know that I feel confident right now in Louisville's ability to flip that, and the way that they're pitching. You know, I don't understand what happened this weekend in Durham at all. Like, I watched more of that series than I would have ever imagined. I do not understand what happened. But I understand what happened in Tallahassee. And, you know, we've seen that before out of Louisville. So getting that corrected just feels like a bigger problem right now than fixing what Texas and Notre Dame are dealing with. All right, let's move on from these teams, Joe. And quickly before we get out of here, let's go to the Sun Belt. Georgia Southern is playing Georgia State. Rivalry series between the top two teams in the standings. And Georgia Southern, for the second week in a row, wins a series against the team that was leading the Sun Belt going into the weekend. They sweep Georgia State. First time they swept Georgia State since 2002. That sounds really good. It's not quite as good as it sounds, frankly, though, because they only have been in the same conference for like 8 years. So they weren't playing an annual series necessarily that whole time, but still. Big weekend for Georgia Southern, which is now into the top 10 in RPI. A lot going on there in Statesboro. If you look at that weekend, and Georgia Southern now also into the top 25 for the first time in about a decade. If you look at the weekend, Georgia Southern just found a way. It was a different way every game, but I was impressed with the way that it wasn't like they just pitched really well all weekend or the bats were going all weekend. They had everything going just at a different time, and they were the ones that found a way to win.
Yeah, it's a team that took some lumps early, and you start to wonder if this is just a case of a team that has found its stride and kind of learned from those early adversities. And look, I mean, they play Tennessee to start the season. And like, we know how that would go for, you know, basically all 300 teams in college baseball at this point. So a team that seems to be finding itself, and they're in a fascinating place. Like, they, you know, they're now in the top 10 in RPI, and we, you know, we talked about how we think they could host there. And that's it's kind of a fascinating storyline to watch as the season moves on. And they've kind of been a nice foil for Texas State here, where Texas State is still leading the conference. And but Georgia Southern has that tiebreaker, having won that series. And I think that's going to be a fun race down the stretch. And Georgia State is still kind of in this thing. But the things that have needed to happen for the Sun Belt to kind of remain relevant have largely happened. You know, that the teams at the bottom are starting to really get beaten up a little bit. The teams at the top are not sweeping each other necessarily, although we had that with Georgia Southern and Georgia State. So it does kind of shape up to be as we kind of hoped when we started to eyeball the Sun Belt about a month ago as a conference to watch for this kind of thing. Like, it has held form that, you know, over the last month of the season, this is going to be a fascinating league to watch how the postseason race shakes up. Because even a team like Georgia State, even with that sweep, they're still sitting at 35 in RPI, still have a nice overall record, you know, 6 wins against RPI top 50. They're still right there. Good result for Georgia Southern, kind of continues to, secure their postseason future and puts them in a position where if they win this thing out and win the Sun Belt, they could be playing some home games in June, which is, look, I mean, we picked this team to win the Sun Belt at the beginning of the year. We certainly never imagined something like that.
No, absolutely not. It's never happened before. They've never hosted. They are a team, a program with a lot of history. It's been a while since they've been in the NCAA tournament now, but a lot of history in that program. So do you think they have to win to host? Because that's kind of where I'm at. But if they manage to keep this top 10 RPI, it might be a bit of a different story. I just think without a Sun Belt trophy of some sort, be that regular season or postseason, I don't know that they get to the host line.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think those two things might be somewhat related, just because, you know, they can't fall to the RPI is going to fall. If they start dropping games to where they're not right there at the top of the conference, the RPI probably falls with it. But look, if they finish inside the top 10, as long as they're at least second place, a game or two back, like, that might be enough. But I'm with you, generally speaking. Like, we could sit here and come up with all kinds of different scenarios that might be interesting in that regard. But yes, generally speaking, I feel like they need to lift a trophy, one or the other, preferably both, to be in a position to host. But certainly that RPI, if it stays in the range where it is right now, is going to put them in position to do so.
Definitely something to watch. Also something to watch in the Sun Belt is that Texas State has slipped out of the top 50 in RPI.
Yeah, that's trouble. I kind of noticed that too. It snuck up on me, but yeah, they've got to get moving.
Arizona's decline has not helped the Bobcats in any way. So yeah, that's something to watch. If they're winning this conference, I think they're going to be rewarded. But again, I mean, a lot of ifs there, a lot of work to do down the stretch for all of these teams. None of them can feel secure right now. I mean, Georgia Southern might feel secure in a regional bid, but I think they've their eyes on more than that right now. So the Sun Belt continues to be an intriguing conference and fascinating series every weekend. Georgia Southern this week has South Alabama, the reigning champs. So it does not lighten too terribly much for the Eagles. All right, that's going to do it for us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. We covered a lot of ground, covering even more ground over on the website. Be sure to check everything out over at baseballamerica.com. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And we will be back here on Thursday for another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast, previewing Week 10. We come at you twice a week here during the regular season, Mondays and Thursdays. So make sure you are subscribed to the Baseball America Podcast in your favorite podcasting app, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Hit the subscribe, hit the follow button, and we come at you twice a week. Alrighty, Joe, that'll do it. Thank you all for listening. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.